This is CHUO 89.1 FM. Welcome to this week's episode of The Mosaic, your weekly show highlighting the voices of the community. Here, we guide you through today's social issues, introduce you to changemakers, and keep in touch with the arts, music, and events of the city. You can expect extensive research, in-depth analysis, and discussion. From CHUO's news team, this is The Mosaic. Today, we celebrate the Ottawa School of Art's 145th anniversary. We'll hear more about the faculty's community work and this year's colorful and creative celebration. Then, a conversation about trans, feminist, and racialized voices in silent film. We speak with Carleton professor Laura Harak about her research ahead of her film screening for the International Film Festival of Ottawa.
That's not the ending of this film at all. And so it's just fun to find these things that defy your expectations about what was possible so many years ago.
We discuss her archival film, Cinema's First Nasty Women, Queens of Destruction. Finally, we dive into the work of Montreal artist Charlotte Cardin.
I feel like a zombie, I'll die at the party.
Stick around. I'm Lauren Rolston, and we've got all that and more coming up on The Mosaic.
The Ottawa School of Arts is celebrating its 145th anniversary. Gerard Bellick is the Outreach Program Coordinator for the faculty. He explains to us about the School of Arts' partnership with different organizations in Ottawa, both old and new.
So we have among the displays here the artworks by street-involved youth at Operation Come Home, ages 16 to 25. This past fall, they decided to publish a coloring book and printed 200 issues of this coloring book that were sold out within days, a week or two at the most. Funds from that sale go directly back to Operation Come Home. We've been a partner with them over the last more than 10 years now. Mm-hmm. And we're very proud to say that we'd love to continue that partnership long into the future as well. Mm-hmm. We've got partnerships with community houses, other social service agencies like Christie Lake Kids, Minwash and Lodge. Options Bytown Housing is one of our newer partners, and that particular partnership is with seniors who are living in sort of rent-controlled housing programs, and we are looking forward to continuing with all of our partners, community houses, community centers, resource centers, and so on.
The Outreach Program is dedicated to giving free community-based art classes to youth facing economic or social disadvantages. On Sunday, the School of Art celebrated its monumental 145th anniversary, and, of course, they celebrated with an art party. This art party is to celebrate and showcase the kids' work depicting what a party could be like. Here's Jared explaining some of the artworks present in their room.
The participants of the outreach program were invited to create artworks that would reflect their thoughts on what a party can be. So we've got a lot of cupcakes and slices of cake made from ceramics, so from clay, and fired in our kilns here. We've got artworks on the wall either depicting cakes or activities done during a party, so dancing and music and games. We've got imaginary creatures that have come down from who knows where to help celebrate our 145th anniversary.
It's also important to note that the School of Art is in their 23rd year of programming. He goes ahead to explain to us what the Ottawa School of Art means to the community.
Here in Ottawa, the Ottawa School of Art is a hub of activity. If there were no Ottawa School of Art, we have 70-some artists who work here over the course of the year, whether part-time as instructors, or perhaps full-time as members of the faculty. It's employment for fine artists working in the visual media, they're painting, printing, sculpture. It's a great place for the community, so citizens of Ottawa, to come and, in our general program, just have a chance to practice drawing, painting, printing, sculpture, a very busy ceramic studio, pottery included. We have a children's and teens program that keeps the children busy and out of trouble on weekends during the school year, and summer camps, March break camps during the daytime. We have, oh my gosh, I'm not the coordinator of that program, but the diploma program, which has been in existence for many years now, is also a source of great pride for the school and the alumni and alumna who are from the area, so they don't have to travel too far or pay too much to achieve a diploma in fine arts, again, their choice of media. And many do remain afterwards here as either employees of the school, teaching, working for the outreach program as artist instructors. So we're just a great resource center for people who are engaged with fine arts and visual arts.
On the subject of community, Dunia, one of the artist instructors, and she tells us a little about what she's learned in the role.
It's a very nice, fulfilling role that makes you connected to your community. And usually the students teach you a lot more than you teach them, for sure.
So basically it's like very interactive. It's a very interactive thing.
Yeah, very collaborative classroom all the time in the arts. If there's any way that you can support the outreach program, it's very helpful because it's the major way that you can give back to the art community and your local community. These are disadvantaged youth that, you know, you can see them right now in the gallery. They're smiling, they're excited, they're happy, they get to forget about everything and just enjoy themselves, and that's what kids are supposed to do.
It was also interesting as there were lots of artworks done by the participants, and we just had to ask what Jared's favorite pieces would be if he had to pick one.
Oh no, the favorite question. If I had to save my life by picking one, there is a slice of cake. Is it cake? It's pottery by one of the participants with Christie Lake Kids. It is a little cake that is frosted pink with a half slice of strawberry on the top. Mm-hmm. And something that looks like a delicious coffee, perhaps, flavored icing. And it is just, it's just delicious. And you have to wonder, is it cake or is it art? I think it's both.
Yeah, it definitely depicts both.
He acknowledges that there are certain barriers that could affect artists in pursuing their passions for art.
But they have to be able to come down to the physical art school itself and take the classes. And what we've learned is that a significant, perhaps the most significant barrier, is transportation. Sometimes even the question of getting on the bus is a big problem. And that's why the outreach program goes to the neighborhoods. We send the artist instructors. We pay for the art supplies. There are no fees, no enrollments. And we do this in the community houses and community centers that are in the neighborhoods. And that helps enormously the young people who would not be able to get on a bus and travel downtown.
And Jared recognizes some of the struggles and challenges out there for young and current artists. He had some advice for them.
Don't lose courage. It's sometimes very difficult and to be an artist these days, finding gallery space for exhibitions, finding whether it be patrons or just connecting with your community. There are various methods that you can use now that did not exist too long ago, but it still often feels like you're working alone in the studio and are not being seen enough. So don't worry, hang on there, keep working, and especially to the young people, There are so many things you can do if you are good at using your hands and coordinating that with your mind and your ideas. There's a future for you in the fine arts, and just hang on there, keep working.
That was CHUO's Marcel Gonzalez, made in collaboration with Faithia Tijani. Laura Harak is a Carleton professor of film studies and author of the book Girls Will Be Boys, Cross-Dressed Women and Lesbians in American Cinema. She and fellow researchers gathered a massive selection of women in films from the silent era, in gendered and racialized roles not typically assumed of women in our society. These roles are celebrated and remembered in the film, cinema's first Nasty Women, Queens of Destruction. I spoke with the professor about her work and research, and what we can learn from these early forms of feminist resistance today. And so I want to talk about cinema's first Nasty Women, the screening that's coming up on March 22nd. And before we get into the content of that screening, I really want to focus on the word nasty there, because it feels intentional, right? Can you tell me about the choice to use the word nasty?
Yeah. So my colleagues, Maggie Hennerfeld, who's a professor in Minnesota, and Elif Rongen-Kainachi, who's an archivist in the Netherlands, got together to make a DVD set that we called Cinema's First Nasty Women, because we're all feminist film historians in different ways. And we look at all of the women and gender nonconforming people who were in early cinema, like cinema when it was first invented, who have been forgotten and written out of film history. And so that includes comedians, that includes cross-dressing women, there's maids, there's athletes, there's heroes, there's also Indigenous and Black performers. And the reason we called it Cinema's First Nasty Women is, first off, because a lot of the women, especially in the comedies, they really are nasty. They're throwing plates, they're flooding the kitchen, they're burning down the house, they're just like causing chaos wherever they go, and just completely disrupting the social order. And we also wanted to make the connection between feminism and women's representation and gender crossing in the beginning of the 20th century and the kind of feminist and queer and trans politics of the 21st century. And of course, Nasty Women became a kind of rallying cry when it was reclaimed after Trump called Hillary Clinton a nasty woman. And so we wanted that kind of exuberance, F you in your face feminist energy that we have today, we saw happening already in the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Like this loud anarchy is a big theme there, I was reading. And I think today we're pretty lucky to live in a time where hate isn't as socially acceptable as it has been in the past. But taking it back to the time when these silent films were made, homophobia, misogyny, racism, transphobia, that was the norm then. So these films, can you tell me how they kind of represent like a form of protest?
Yeah, and I would argue that both in good and bad ways, there's not as many differences between now and then as we might think. So whereas it's true, there was like, you know, women were different legally, like at the beginning of the silent era, women in the US and Canada couldn't vote, you know, and they weren't allowed into many jobs, and they were supposed to be wearing dresses and things and corsets that were really physically constraining. But it was also the time of like a big labor movement that women were very involved in. There was lots of, you know, feminism. Women were locking themselves to public buildings and very kind of in your face activism for getting women the vote. And there was actually also really, there was a presence of people who had genders that they weren't assigned at birth. And there were people who were in cities like living with partners who were the same sex. And even though it wasn't named in the same way and it wouldn't have been spoken about publicly as often, when you see people like that in the movies, like people would, audiences would recognize them. So it's true that, you know, there's a lot of kind of really blatant racism, including some of what you'll see in these films. These are by no means perfect. We didn't want to whitewash this history. But you'll also see, for example, in the films that are showing at the Mayfair, there's a Black woman who is giving laughing gas at the dentist, and then her laughter completely disrupts public space, including the police and the justice system. You can see her force like overturning these you know, these forces of oppression in society. And there's one of the films called Rowdy Ann stars a comedian Faye Tincher, who was living out unashamedly with her female partner her whole life. And she plays this rambunctious cowgirl who like everyone loves. So even though she's like this great shot, she's boxing, she's riding horses, she wasn't seen as kind of perverse or something wrong with her. She was seen as this heroine. So we can be surprised by the kind of space there was even 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago in some cases, for these women who break social norms.
Mm-hmm. And I kind of want to pull on a little bit about what you said earlier about how it's a little more similar today and back then than we might expect. Can you tell me more about what you mean by that?
I mean, one thing that's interesting is that there were actually in the early part of cinema, more women directors, producers, writers than there are now, actually.
Wow. Wow.
And so we've actually moved backwards. And so it's great. I mean, we obviously need more women in all, and also women comedians. You know, we need more women in these positions now, but we think, oh, we're the best it's ever been. But actually, we're like maybe the second best it's ever been after these first decades of cinema. And I think the questions that the labor movement was raising at the time about sexual harassment, about safe working conditions, about the differences between the lower classes and the upper classes, like none of these are things that we have resolved. So I think a lot of the things that they were fighting for then are also things we're fighting for now.
I had no idea about that. That's huge. And thinking back about these as forms of protest, the messages that get delivered through media, it's we're hearing queer voices, racialized voices, Black voices, and non-traditional feminine voices. So what do we know about in your research? I'm assuming this took a lot of time to put together these films. So what have you found about how common this kind of resistance is? Was that hard to find?
You know, that's a good question. So it's both hard and not hard to find. It was very common, like cross-dressing women in early silent cinema. I did this research originally for my dissertation, my PhD dissertation, and I found more than 500 examples just in American silent cinema alone. So again, very common, popular, not necessarily seen as something even worth remarking. But most of those films in general in the silent era, at least 80%, if not 90%, have been lost. So the majority of silent films in general are not available today. And of that 10% that survives, the ones that we're talking about have not been available on DVD or streaming. They have just been in archives where archivists have preserve them, luckily. So that's why Maggie and Alif and I decided to make a DVD project in the first place, was because we had, you know, flown all over the world to see two archives to see these in person, but we knew most people cannot do that, sadly. And so we worked with Kino Lorber, a film distributor, to make really good new digitizations of them and to work with contemporary musicians to make really good new scores and release them on DVD, and also to show them in theaters like we're doing at the Mayfair. So the whole DVD set has 99 films. We could have made it, it could have been at probably 400 films if we had all the time and money in the world. So there really are a lot. Even in that small number that survived, there's still a lot. And then we take a selection of those and show them live in theater with live music like we're doing at the Mayfair. And we've also been showing this in Turkey and Italy and Finland and the UK and throughout the United States and Mexico. So the Nasty Women have been having a world tour since we were able to bring them out of the archives and out to the people.
Wow. It's like a big piece of European and American cinema history is what I'm hearing. And it sounds like a big part of this mission was like preserving history, because like you said, a lot of it has been lost already. And I'm going to ask kind of like a technical question, but what does it mean when films are lost?
Yeah. So films, you know, they were made on celluloid nitrate, and they would make a bunch of copies and then they would circulate. And then when they were done with them, usually they would just throw them away, essentially recycle the materials. And also those materials could be used for ammunition and things. So like certainly during wartime, it was valuable, particularly valuable material. And like lots and lots and lots of films were being made all the time. And so there was not that many people who were like, oh, we should hang on to these for the future, that these will have some kind of value. There were some, There was a few. And museums at the time, like art museums, didn't necessarily see film as an artwork that was worthy of preservation. And the thing about cellulose nitrate is that it could spontaneously combust. Mm. So you probably heard about that. There used to be a lot of fires. And so it's difficult to preserve. You have to keep it cold. You have to keep it dry. You ideally want to keep it separate from everything else, just in case it does catch on fire. So what that means is that the majority of films made during this period, either through neglect or by mistake, it's a really sad story. The Swedish Film Institute saved all of their silent films. But then in 1941, there was an archive fire and it burned up most of them. And so very few films from that period survive until 2024. And in fact, actually American and French films, which is where a lot of our films are from, survive better than many other places. I mean, Japanese films are almost all gone from this early period. So yeah, I mean, the good news is that we do find new silent films every year. Like people will find them at flea markets, or they might be in someone's basement. Maybe an old cinema shut down and in a closet they had something, or an archive had a reel of something and they didn't know what it was, and then we identify it. So some of the things that are lost will still be found, but most of them probably won't be.
Mm-hmm. I have like 1,000 questions that I could ask you about just that hunt of going around the world, going to those archives and seeing hundreds of movies. I guess to boil it down, what was that experience like for you?
Well, it was really fun for sure, because taking film studies as an undergraduate, I just thought, well, like film history is set. Like we know what it is. It already happened. And people have had a lot of time to think about it, too. So when I discovered that there were so many films that to my eyes looked so queer and so trans and so feminist and so modern, I was shocked that there was this whole part of film history that I had no idea about, even though I was a big film fan and knew quite a bit about film. So then you have to start working with archivists because they have this encyclopedic knowledge of their own archives. And there are some great resources. There is a online database, subscription database, that the International Federation of Film Archives has put together for silent films. So you can look up titles and names of directors and actors and see which archives in different parts of the world have copies of those. But there's always other films, because if you're looking for something like cross-dressing or something like women comedians or maids who, you know, light things on fire, like that might not be just a title you can look up. You might have to ask people who know about the themes of the films. And so me and Maggie have been going to silent film festivals. Like there's a big one in Italy called Pordenone Silent Film Festival in October, and meeting with archivists, meeting with other researchers, and just asking around. And so we'll just hear from people like, hey, have you seen this? Or, oh, I just came across that. Or we just got this donation you might be interested in. So there's both like doing the research. Also, I looked at a lot of film reviews, first in collections that had been made of New York Times and Variety film reviews. But then once they digitized so many different film periodicals and also newspapers, I could look up things like In Her Brother's Clothing, or like these common plot tropes of cross-dressing. So I could find a bunch more titles. And again, many of those will be lost, but then I could look up those titles in the database and find more. So when I was doing this research, I flew to LA, to DC, to Paris, to Berlin. Also here in Ottawa, Library and Archives Canada has some films that are unique in the world, cross-dress women films. So we're lucky in that way to be close to a national archive. But it is really like a detective hunt, and you do sort of follow clues and follow trails. And I'm sure there's still more out there that I haven't found yet.
Mm-hmm. There must be this kind of like eureka moment when you do find a good one, like one of those pearls. What were some of the shocking moments that came to you when you were researching this project?
Shocking. Well, some of the films that were most exciting to me was films that Minnie Devereaux, who also performed under the name Minnie Hee-Haw. She's Cheyenne in Arapaho. And I had seen her in a bit part in a Mabel Normand feature comedy, and she's very good. But I knew from the title that she was in a film with Fatty Arbuckle, and she co-starred with him in a short comedy. But there was no way to preview it, and the descriptions we had were like very vague. But we're like, okay, if she's the co-star, this has got to be a good film. Let's pay to get this digitized. Like, I think we can include it. And so it was digitized, and it's like amazing. She's so good. She's hilarious. We actually showed this last year at the Mayfair, and it's also on the DVD set. So she is, you know, a comedian in her own right who can certainly hold her own against Thyati Arbuckle, one of the great silent film comedians. And all we knew was a name. All we knew was the title. And so we were really lucky that it ended up being as great as it was. I was really happy when I found Rowdy Ann, when I saw that for the first time, and that's a film showing at the Mayfair this year. It shows this really kind of masculine girl, but she's just beloved. There's no problem with her. She does have to kind of have some of her rough edges sanded off. Her father sends her to a boarding school to learn to be a lady. But in the end, she saves the day by retaining her kind of Western physical prowess, by being able to like rope in, I don't want to give it away, but she uses her roping skills in the city to kind of save the day. And so a lot of times these films will really reform the masculine woman and have her marry, you know, a man and become very feminine. But like, that's not the ending of this film at all. And so it's just fun to find these things that defy your expectations about what was possible so many years ago.
So Rowdy Ann is like kind of celebrated for her rowdiness. It's not like a term. Right. Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah. I want to take it to a point in time where today there are a lot of people who kind of point back to this the way things were. They wish things would go back to the way things were. And they romanticize this idea of before queerness and before gender nonconformity. But with that in mind, and after all this research that you've even said has shown all these examples of cross-dressing too, what does this add to that conversation?
Well, clearly, there was no before queerness or before gender nonconformity or gender creativity. And this period, 100, 110, 120 years ago, was actually a time of like very active women breaking out of boundaries, people breaking out of gendered norms. There was one actor who was assigned female at birth, but only performed in male roles and was celebrated for those and went by a male name, you know? So like none of these things are new. We didn't invent them 10 years or 20 years ago or anything. And in some ways there was more room for female masculinities 100 years ago than there is now. Like almost every actress at the time would have a cross-dressing role or two or three or four or five, you know, people love to see women taking on different kinds of gendered roles and different kinds of sexual roles. There's all kinds of like same-sex flirtation in these films too. Like they were not, you know, some kind of innocents who didn't know what same-sex desire or what gender play was. It was very much a part of the culture. And films were really responding to like mass culture, pop culture, what like the people in general, working class people knew about. So what some forms of art can be really restricted to the more elite classes, but films were being seen by everyone. And so it just shows how rich the gender and sexuality and the politics were 100 years ago, 120 years ago. And any kind of nostalgia, you know, a fake nostalgia for this time before things got complicated with like wokeism and gender ideology is just, it's completely false. It's totally a lie. That time didn't exist.
Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in that comparison that you kind of made about like feminine roles that we're seeing today. There might not be as much room to play within the masculine side. Can you tell me more about how we see that unroll in media, films, TV today?
There is certainly more room for actual characters who identify as trans and who are played by trans actors. And that is great and important, you know, and really essential and hard fought. But within the roles that are given to your average actress, like there's a pretty narrow range of gender kind of performance that's allowed. Like they're generally, you know, beautiful. And if one in 20 is not beautiful, it's like this, you know, shocking thing that should be talked about and analyzed, you know, and slender. And, you know, there's these certain sort of types and you know, once in a while, again, they'll be like, oh, someone's wearing a suit or something. But there used to be just like this huge range of kind of masculine styles that women used to wear in the movies, from, you know, from working class to Western to upper class to things where they just are women, but they like masculine styles, or things where they disguise themselves as men and, you know, fool everyone. Or also there were actresses who played male roles. That was totally common as well, especially in the 19 teens. So you just don't see that. Like, if there is any kind of, like, you know, masculinity or masculine disguise to performance, you know, it'll be so uncommon that it's very remarkable. Whereas there just used to be a lot wider range of types of roles for women, including different kinds of gender performances in the 19-teens and 1920s.
Mm-hmm. And so there's a clear history there pointing to that these voices were still there. They were still making noise. They're existing. And today, like you've said, there's still issues. There's still a long way to go. What do you hope to see in the films of the future?
Well, certainly I want the money to be given to all of the different women, BIPOC, trans, queer, immigrants, people who have interesting stories to tell. So it's not just the same old, Oppenheimer just won a million Oscars. It's just the same old stories of, like, men who are, like, vaguely confused about what to do and who have all this money and power. And it's, like, so hard, their lives, you know. I just, there are other people making movies, you know, and really good ones, and who are coming up through film school and who are making movies on their own. And they are just not getting the same kind of funding. They're not getting the same kind of grants. And so one of my other projects is the Transgender Media Portal, which is going to be like IMDb, but for trans filmmakers and their works. We're going to launch it this June. So look out for that. But we show that there's hundreds of trans filmmakers who have been making films for many decades, and they're actually really great. And you can watch many of them online, others that you can rent through a distributor, or you can buy through Amazon or something. And so it's not that, like, oh, we need more trans people making movies. I mean, we do, but also there's hundreds of trans people making movies. They just need more money, and they need more distribution budgets and publicity budgets for the movies they're already making. So I would love to see the money and the people who make the money decisions radically change from just the same old that we tend to get.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of running to the end of my questions here, but for my last one, it's when you're watching a movie, you're watching someone alive and being themselves. It's like you feel a bit of a connection there. I want to know if you have a message, or, you know, if you could go back in time and say something to these women and these performers who made the films, what would that message be?
Well, I think that they probably had no idea the significance and importance of what they were doing. They were just working. They were making one movie a week, you know, trying to pay the bills, trying to do what felt interesting and funny to them. But I'm sure they would be very surprised if they were told that 100, 120 years from now, there would be people watching them and laughing and applauding and being inspired by them. So I think just letting them know that this work that they did on the fly is still important and is still something for us to learn from 120 years later.
Did you have anything else that you wanted to add?
I just want to emphasize that there's nothing like seeing a movie with live music. And we have two great musicians, James McGowan, who is a music professor at Carleton in my department, and also Valerie Neherova, who's a percussionist. And so there's something really unique about being able to watch these in a big, beautiful theater like the Mayfair with excellent musicians playing along. So I encourage you to come out.
Of course, yeah. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
All right, thank you.
Cinema's first Nasty Women, Queens of Destruction, will be screened at the Mayfair Theatre on March 22nd at 7 p.m. as part of the programming for the International Film Festival of Ottawa. And now CHUO's Marcela Gonzalez on Charlotte Cardin's recent visit to Ottawa.
The energy with which Ottawa said goodbye and received the Montreal singer Charlotte Cardin. After the announcement of her tour in May of last year, Cardin has been traveling around North America and Europe, promoting her latest album, 99 Nights. At first, 40 tour dates were posted for the extensive tour, but it was only later that she added Ontario cities to the list, including Ottawa and Toronto. But it seems like the National Capital Region was extra lucky, because she performed in Ottawa in the beginning of February and decided to open a second date for the 22nd. On that chilly night, her show was opened by New West, a Toronto-based band composed of songwriters and instrumentalists that have released standard songs like Balenciaga and Those Eyes, and that filled the audience with enthusiasm as Cardine stepped onto the stage. She opened the show with Looping, where she explores a mental stage of obsession and confusion, of someone who only sees life as black and white. Shallow Cardin's popularity and success have come steadily and naturally. Her career started as a model when she was 15, but she first showed her musical talent in the singing competition La Voix, where she placed as a top finalist. That same year, in 2013, she was featured in the album of Canadian singer and actor Garou. Garou invited her to make an appearance on one of the sister shows of The Voice. She released her first EP in 2016, but it was Main Girl, her second one, that would get her first Juno Awards nominations. The Juno Awards are presented by the Canadian Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences to acknowledge musical artists from Canada. They include not only the prize awarding ceremony, but also concerts, a comedy show, and discussions with special guests. After the release of her first album, Phoenix, Cardine made history as the most nominated artist in 2022 and now again in 2024. She has participated in major festivals like Lollapalooza and Oceaga. And from the moment she was in front of us, I instantly grasped why. And I knew that even if I wasn't in one of those massive venues, I was still witnessing something incredible. She performed songs from Phoenix and Main Girl, and in that mix of new and old songs, you could tell her music and style had evolved. She moved across the stage with confidence, prompting us to sing along, and dancing when beats like Dirty Dirty came on. And with more whimsical songs like Anyone Who Loves Me, she had us move to the core. If there was one song that brought the arena together, however, that has to be Confetti. As the sultry pop beat started, so did the screams. Suddenly everyone was standing up, forgetting their winter clothes and drinks.
I feel like a zombie, I'll die at the party. Yeah, you're from my body, fully covered in confetti.
And I found myself singing and dancing alongside the crowd, absorbing a contagious energy that made me think, wow, this is what a concert is supposed to be like. This was the first song Cardine had released as a single before 99 Nights came out, marking her return to the musical stage after nearly 2 years since the release of Phoenix. In this ode to introverts, as the artist described it in a press release, she explores the feelings of inadequacy, of a standoffishness that she has felt at every party she's gone to. Her lyrics express inner monologues and contradictions, an irrational fear of one's death going unnoticed by confetti. Although this uncomfortable experience is shared by many people, it still remains a show of vulnerability from Cardine. Something which I think is deeply characteristic of her music, transforming into art that which we have all experienced but dare not to say. Through 12 songs, Cardine was able to expand her musical feel without the pressure that comes with a musician's first album. 99 Nights is the result of a close knit of friends wanting to make good music and to capture the present moments. In a way, this concert felt like one continuous intimate conversation with her. Just that instead of filling the time with speeches, she let the music speak for herself. It was after Confetti 2 that the lights went out and everyone stayed still, hoping that the concert wasn't over yet.
We have a couple more for you.
But she came back, and during the very last three songs, she had the crowd's emotion going haywire. One moment we were shouting Feel Good and Main Girl, and the next one we were touched by Next to You, especially after Cardine's introduction of the song.
Il nous reste une chanson à vous faire, au piano, cette fois-ci. Je voulais finir pour qu'on soit un petit peu entre nous, comme ça, sur un moment un peu plus doux, un peu plus intime. Et j'avais envie de finir sur la chanson qui est certainement la chanson la plus personnelle de l'album. It's a song that I wrote with my dear friend Patrick Watson. And writing music with him was a dream come true. And we wrote the song in his studio in Montreal, and it took us about 9 months to write the song. It was a really, really long process. And so I keep this whole chapter of my life, this song, that moment with Patrick, very, very close to my heart. Thank you for the lovely evening. This was really, really special. Et cette chanson s'appelle Next Year.
She played the piano and was joined by a group of violinists. Together, they truly elevated the great finale, honing the past hour and a half and highlighting the ballad's message of sometimes letting things go.
Maybe it's the fact that I can't go back now. Maybe it's the rivers that must come
out. For C2O, that was Marcela Gonzalez. And that's it for this week's episode of The Mosaic. Thanks so much for tuning in. Music for The Mosaic is by Helizna. To listen to this episode and previous ones, go to chuo.fm/podcasts. If you're interested in joining our news team, email news@chuo.fm. We'll see you next week, Thursday at 1 p.m.